Welcome to the Bone Coach Show, dedicated to helping you understand all things related to diet, lifestyle, bone health, and how you can live and thrive with low bone density and osteoporosis. I'm your host, Kevin Ellis, certified health coach, health and wellness speaker, and above all else, your bone coach. After being diagnosed with osteoporosis in my early 30s, I transformed my health through diet and lifestyle and now help my clients and community members do the same through my online coaching practice, BoneCoach.com. Look, there are no quick and easy cures for low bone density, but the choices we make every single day can have a powerful impact on our bones, our health, and our general well-being. I'll share the research, interview the experts, and help you figure out how to get the conditions right in your body so you can better your bones through diet and lifestyle. Short disclaimer, I'm not a medical doctor and this show should not be considered medical advice. Always consult with your healthcare team before making medical decisions and changes to your diet and lifestyle. With that being said, let's get on with the show.
People come to intermittent fasting out of a curiosity. They want to change body composition. They want to lose weight. But I remind them there's so many other benefits. Well, when we're in an unfed state, as we are becoming more metabolically flexible, as we are becoming more insulin sensitive, when insulin levels are low, our body can go and free up stored fat as a fuel source. And our bodies really run very efficiently on stored fat. So it improves energy. We can also produce a special type of ketones that can be crossed the blood-brain barrier. So brain-derived neurotrophic factor crosses the blood-brain barrier, allows for tremendous mental clarity. I find for a lot of people, this is oftentimes a very surprising benefit. They're like, wow, I feel like I can do anything.
If you haven't done so already, especially if you're newly diagnosed with osteopenia or osteoporosis, or if your most recent bone density scan still showed more bone loss, go ahead and pause this episode and head over to BoneCoach.com to sign up for your free 7-day osteoporosis kickstart guide. That's going to give you everything you need step by step by step over the next 7 days to get on the path to improvement and stronger bones. You won't want to miss that. So pause this right now, head over to BoneCoach.com and I'll be here as soon as you get back. Welcome to this episode of the Bone Coach Show. Joining us today to explore if when you eat can help prevent your health decline is Cynthia Thurlow. Cynthia Thurlow is a nurse practitioner, author of the best-selling book, Intermittent Fasting Transformation, a 2-time TEDx speaker with her second talk having more than 14 million views, and the host of the Everyday Wellness podcast, averaging over 150,000 downloads per month. With over 20 years experience in health and wellness, Cynthia is a globally recognized expert in intermittent fasting and women's health and has been featured on ABC, Fox, KTLA, CW, Medium, Entrepreneur, and The Megyn Kelly Show. Her mission is to educate women on the benefits of intermittent fasting and overall holistic health and wellness so they feel empowered to live their most optimal lives. Cynthia, it is great to have you here.
So good to be here, Kevin.
I'm looking forward to this. So can we talk about, I know you're an expert on fasting. You've written books on this. You've spoken extensively on this. But let's even talk about maybe how did you get into this field and understanding the importance of fasting?
Yeah, I think it really starts from my career started as a bit of an adrenaline junkie. I was first an ER nurse in inner city Baltimore, and then it was a natural transition to cardiology. I had lots of exciting things, flying in choppers and managing acutely sick patients. But after becoming a parent, I got much more interested in lifestyle medicine. I had a child with life-threatening food allergies. And so I kind of pivoted and did more clinical cardiology, less in the hospital, more in the clinic, because I had a more predictable schedule. And so over time, I kept seeing the same people coming back and getting more medication. And yeah, we were managing symptoms, but their medications were 20, 30 prescription drugs. They were having more procedures. And I kept asking, could there be any interrelationship with our nutrition and our sleep and our stress management? And, you know, for me, it really became an exercise in futility. I felt like I didn't have enough time to talk to my patients about the things that I felt like were most important. I couldn't properly counsel them on the nutrition and the sleep and the stress and the exercise management like I needed to. And so in 2016, I took a massive leap of faith and left clinical cardiology. However, before then, the power of the N of one. So for me, I was the typical early perimenopausal woman who all of a sudden became weight loss resistant, and everything I'd been telling my patients wasn't effective. Every bit of information that I learned as a student, as a clinician, was not working. And I thought, you know, this really speaks to the fact that a lot of the information we're giving our patients is really not evidence-based. It's well-intentioned, but isn't particularly helpful when someone says, you know, this is just the normal function of aging. You're going to gain weight. I was like, I don't buy into that. So I came to intermittent fasting out of a desire to change body composition and lose weight, admittedly. But what I found nearly instantly was that I had more mental clarity, more energy. I slept better. I felt better. And that to me made me realize that this is a really powerful strategy and one that I was willing to talk to any patient that was willing to talk to me about it. And so when I left clinical medicine in 2016, it's almost 7 years ago now, I remember that almost instantly I started attracting women just like myself who felt like they were underserved, underrepresented. And of course, intermittent fasting was part of that. And so I've been talking to women about this for almost 7 years and feeling very comfortable and confident in saying that we do best when we have more digestive rest. And that can look very different for each one of us. But my story is the power of the N of one. I think it is for so many people, but there's so much good research and there's so much, you know, when you start to look at the research on metabolic health here in the United States and how only 7% of the population is metabolically healthy, you realize it's time for us to start getting much more, how shall I say, much more assertive about ways that we can help empower our patients and have them not be a byproduct of the kind of chronic medical model where you just keep adding medications and, you know, patients just accept that they're going to get weaker, less strong, you know, not be able to lift things, not be able to function optimally with each decade of their lives. And I feel it's really important that we set a kind of standard that that doesn't have to be the case.
I love how empowering that is. I mean, that's important, like to be the patient, to feel educated and empowered and confident that you can help drive your health forward in a positive direction. I think that is so, so important. Now let's talk about fasting, right? And we're going to get to fasting and bone health in a little bit, but let's talk about the basics because some people may not even really understand what fasting is. So can you explain what is fasting?
Yeah, I think this is an important question. Fasting is eating less often. There's different types of fasting in terms of duration of time that you go without eating, but it is really just understanding that there's a time in the day to eat and there's time in the day when we don't eat. And most of the time when we're not eating, we're sleeping. So it really isn't as scary as, you know, many people believe it to be, but it can be a little bit challenging in terms of, you know, we've become somewhat rigidly dogmatic that we want to eat snacks and mini meals. And I oftentimes will encourage patients to understand that our bodies are really optimized when we're not eating all the time. We're not drinking sugary beverages. So really thinking back to the fact we wouldn't be here as a species if we had not been able to go through periods of feasting and famine, and also kind of reinforcing the fact that this concept is not new or novel. It dates back to biblical times. You know, any of the major religions have some thread of fasting as part of their rituals. So when I talk to patients about fasting, it's helping them understand that they could very likely just have 12, 13, 14 hours of a period of fasting in their lifestyle, that you can fast intermittently. It doesn't have to be a 24-hour fast. It doesn't have to be a two-day fast. It could be that you fast for 15 hours or you fast for 14 hours, or if you're brand new to it, you don't eat for 12 hours and that's still providing benefits. Now, there are always extremists. There are always people that say, if a little bit of fasting is good, more is better. I'm sure that we'll talk about the fact that it's all about the role of hormesis, beneficial stress in the right amount at the right time, much like anything, exercise, certain types of foods, cold exposure, which I know you're a huge proponent of, heat exposure, all of which right amount at the right time. And fasting is no different. Now, some of the more common, you know, intervals in terms of fasting can be 16 hours fasted with an 8-hour feeding window. That's a 16-8. That's what I talk about in my book. There are things like alternate day fasting, which means you fast for one day, then you eat, quote unquote, normally like two or three meals the next day, then you fast again. There can be a 5-2, which a 5-2, there's two different ways to do it. It could be 5 days of your normal eating pattern and 2 days of less than 500 calories a day if you're a woman, less than 600 calories a day if you're a man. That's kind of torturous, quite honestly. Or you could do those 2 days, you could just have a 24-hour fast. A lot of it depends on where you are in your life stage. It depends on if you're still menstruating. It depends on what else is going on in your personal and professional life as to which one is the best. But those are the most common ones that I typically see. But I'm a proponent of intermittent fasting because it's a whole lot easier for people to stick to a schedule that's a little bit more of a routine as opposed to an episodic schedule. But it really depends on the individual.
And within this eating window, how many meals is a person consuming within that window?
Again, this really depends on the individual. I know that there are proponents of something called OMAD, one meal a day. And I don't have a problem if you go on vacation, you've overindulged, the next day you're really not hungry, maybe you have one meal. However, as a sustainable strategy in order to be able to hit your protein metrics, and I think protein is the most important macronutrient, in order to hit those protein metrics, you really have to be eating at least two, if not three meals a day, and having anywhere from 30 to 50 grams of protein with each meal. It really depends on your ideal body weight. So I'm 120 pounds. I aim for 100 grams of protein a day. That's a good threshold for me. If you're a taller, bigger person, I'm kind of short. You might have 150 grams of what you're aiming for a day. So that gives you a sense strategically as to how many meals you need. I find for women in particular, they may not be as hungry and they'll say, oh, that one meal a day is fine. No, it's not, because eventually you will end up losing muscle mass. And we actually need more protein as we get older. This is something that maybe not a lot of people talk about, but understanding that muscle protein synthesis, we have this threshold that we have to hit. And for women in particular, as we're losing estrogen, which is an anabolic hormone, as we're losing estrogen and as our follicular stimulating hormone is rising in response to ovarian failure, which is, you know, perimenopause into menopause, it's important to understand that women in particular, men too, need more protein as they get older. So if you think it's just an issue for younger people, it's not. And so when I look about strategizing about meal frequency, it really comes down to how much protein can you get in that meal? And I aim for about 60 grams in my first and then 40 in my other. If I can hit those protein thresholds, then I'm fine with two. Now, are there days I'm playing catch up? Absolutely. Today is one of those days. I will probably have a bigger meal at the end of the day. And it's just that flexible. It's like you get the opportunity to decide when you break your fast, how many meals you eat within your feeding window, and then deciding what works best for you. And I think experimentation is really helpful and very beneficial.
And I love how you're talking about this, not as if fasting is starving, right? You're still talking about getting the nourishment your body needs to support your muscle. Protein is so important for your bones as well. And just getting the other nutrients and minerals that you need throughout the day. So having additional meals in there is going to allow you to do that. So I'm glad you brought that up. And then let's talk about what are the benefits of fasting? So a lot of times people are, you know, they get hungry and they're like, oh my gosh, I have to eat. I have to eat. Well, what happens if they don't feel the need of have to eat?
Yeah, I think that's such an important distinction. So when we think about the basics, people come to intermittent fasting out of a curiosity. They want to change body composition. They want to lose weight. But I remind them there's so many other benefits. Well, when we're in an unfed state, as we are becoming more metabolically flexible, as we are becoming more insulin sensitive, when insulin levels are low, our body can go and free up stored fat as a fuel source. And our bodies really run very efficiently on stored fat. So it improves energy. We can also produce a special type of ketones that can be crossed the blood-brain barrier. So brain-derived neurotrophic factor crosses the blood-brain barrier, allows for tremendous mental clarity. I find for a lot of people, this is oftentimes a very surprising benefit. They're like, wow, I feel like I can do anything. There's also a reduction in inflammation because your body's not trying to process all this large boluses of food throughout the day and sugary beverages and seed oils. So many people get derived benefits from, you know, stem cell activation, the digestive rest. So they don't have as much bloating. Maybe they're less constipated. Maybe they understand that optimizing certain key digestive processes like the migrating motor complex, which is literally like a street sweeper in the digestive system, kind of pushing things, parasites, things that don't belong forward, but we really need 4 hours in between meals. I also think about all those biophysical markers. So lipids, fasting insulin, fasting blood sugar, high blood pressure or blood pressure in general, waist circumference, all are definitely triglycerides, HDL, all are directly impacted by reducing the frequency with which we eat. We know it lessens our likelihood of developing neurocognitive disorders. So things like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, so important, especially as we are seeing more and more aging adults, in particular women, that are going on to develop type 3 diabetes, which is Alzheimer's. And one little caveat that I want to mention is our brains in our 60s, 70s, and beyond are made in our 40s and 50s. So if you think it's not important, it is very important. Our metabolic health is very important. And then I think about, you know, research that's been done about certain types of cancer. So when we think about some of the key things that are going on, quote unquote, behind the scenes, it's a concept called autophagy. It's this waste and recycling process that goes in. So our body's going in and getting rid of disease, disordered cells that have the potential to go on and develop disease or develop precancerous lesions. And so much like we take out the trash and we put it out at the end of our driveway, our body in an unfed state can go in and really upregulate this process. Now, the longer that you fast, the more autophagy will, you know, you will kind of upregulate that key biologic process. But it doesn't mean that you don't get benefits with shorter fasts. I think that's a common misnomer. People say, oh, well, autophagy turns on at 24 hours. No, not really. And we can't measure it in humans, right? We just know based on lab research where it looks like things start to speed up. But I remind people, you're doing a lot of benefits, even if you go 15 or 16 hours without eating. Those are some of the most common ones that I think people are able to kind of grasp and understand. But I always say they come for the body composition changes and weight loss, and they stay for all the other benefits. But in particular, the energy levels and also the cognitive clarity, which, I mean, who doesn't want more of that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's so important too. You're giving your digestive system a break. We don't want our digestive system to just constantly be processing, because we need it to be available. You need to be able to heal and repair other tissues in your body. And if you're constantly digesting, you're just not going to be able to do that as efficiently. So.
Yeah. I'm all about efficiency, although it's not a particularly sexy topic.
Definitely not. And let's talk about, like, are there people that should not fast?
This is a very important question. So I think that we really start with the basics. Children, if you're growing, you should not be fasting. I have teenagers, they eat voluminous amounts of food. I cannot fathom that they would be able to develop into the very lean, muscular individuals that they are becoming if they were restricting food. So definitely children or people that are still developing. Women that are pregnant or breastfeeding. I'm sorry. I know there are fit pros out there that love to kind of push this, and I remind people, if you are growing a human or feeding a human, not the time to restrict your caloric intake. I don't make it about calories. I do make it about macros. And I just think you're putting yourself, you're setting yourself up to be at a disadvantage. I think about individuals that are brittle diabetics. So if you are a diabetic and you're not even aware of when your blood sugar is low, not a great strategy. Anyone that's on chronic medication, I'm not suggesting that you can't fast, because I've had plenty of patients come off blood pressure medicines and lipid lowering agents, but have a conversation with your prescribing provider. Let them know this is what you're doing. I also think it's important to be really clear about those with a history of disordered relationship with food. So bulimics, anorexics, binge eaters, there are always exceptions, but if you and your therapist, psychiatrist, psychologist have decided you are healthy enough and healed enough to be able to participate, I have had several women who have been able to intermittent fast successfully without re-triggering their eating disorder, but that hasn't been the norm per se. But definitely if you have a history of a disordered relationship with food, you really have to ask yourself, is this serving you? Because I do see kind of the ugly side of fasting is, I think for some people, it helps them hide their eating disorder. So I think you have to be very careful, conscientious, if you're prone to those kinds of intrusive thoughts. But beyond that, I really think that it's a strategy that most individuals can do very well with. I think that women have to fast differently than men. So number one, if you're a lean 25-year-old, you probably can get by with maybe fasting in your follicular phase of your menstrual cycle a few times, but not every day. If you have PCOS and you're the same age, you would probably very likely benefit for fasting more frequently, given the fact that you have inflammation, oxidative stress, and insulin resistance at the basis. And then we kind of look at perimenopausal women who are their own special bucket of humans. And so they really have to be conscientious about sleep and stress and over-exercising and the right types of nutrition. I tell everyone, I love being a middle-aged woman, but everything changes, and not necessarily in a bad way. We have to be more attuned to managing our sleep and our stress, right types of exercise, because our bodies become a little less stress resilient. So beyond that, menopausal women and men have probably the easiest time because they have less fluctuation of hormones throughout the month. They tend to have the easiest time with fasting. And so I always like to provide that distinction that I think it's important and responsibly. Obviously, I talk about this in the book pretty extensively, but being a responsible clinician, I have to actually say, depending on where you are in life stage, you may have to really lean into where you are in your menstrual cycle and also be honest with yourself. Are you in a position where you're going to lose muscle mass, or you are, you know, not metabolically healthy and you may benefit from more fasting? But making sure that you are honest about what your goals are and making sure they're actionable.
I'm so glad you brought up kids too, as an important consideration, because sometimes when people take on, you know, a health journey or they start implementing a protocol in their own life, we think that that's just going to apply to everybody around us too. And we may carry that forward to our children. What we have to understand for our kids is that we're in this peak phase of bone development also. And that's going to happen. The majority of that is going to happen before they turn age 18. So restricting their food for extended periods of time, not going to be a good thing. So I'm glad you brought that up.
Well, and I think for a lot of listeners, myself included, I want to be fully transparent and say that I was that typical, you know, teenager, young adult. My periods were all over the place. My OBGYN thought they were doing me a favor to put me on oral contraceptives. And how many people lose out on their peak bone building years because they're kept in a low estrogen state by synthetic hormones? I know that's not the topic of our conversation, but I'm starting to speak more openly about this because I think one of the reasons why, as a middle-aged woman, I am osteopenic despite doing all of the right things is because I missed out on those opportunities. I was on oral contraceptives until I got married. So when I got married at 32 and went off, I had no idea that I had missed out on 10 plus years of being able to continue to build bone. And so I think for anyone that's listening, that's in my age range, there's probably many of us starting to realize this for ourselves. So just keep that in mind. There's no judgment. If you're on oral contraceptives, I totally get it. But just, you know, keep in mind that if you're in that low estrogen state for long periods of time, it has a large net impact on your bone health.
If the women listening have maybe kids of their own that are making these decisions or at these decision points, or maybe like a daughter-in-law or something, what advice would you give to them?
Well, I think first and foremost, I'm a realist. I have all boys, so I'll just be totally transparent. So this isn't a conversation that we've had to have. We've had other conversations. I think it's understanding, like getting full, like being fully informed about whatever decision you use for contraception, or if you're on this because your hormones are just all over the place, or you've got acne, there's a lot of different indications for oral contraceptives, but fully understand there's lots of options. There are certain types of IUDs. There are, now there's like, you know, things like DAISY where you can, you know, monitor symptoms. And I know you probably have to be in a very committed relationship, and by no means am I suggesting that anyone not be in a committed relationship when they're sexually active, but helping people understand there are more options than just oral contraceptives. But if that's the only option you have, I would say stay on them for the shortest duration of time that is possible so that you're not adversely impacting bone health. I think about, you know, I mentioned the IUD, I mentioned, condoms, there's barrier methods. There are all sorts of apps now that can track cervical mucus that can help you understand about your body, like where you might be in your menstrual cycle. And I think there are certainly more options now than there were when I was a single person and even when I first met my husband. And so I think if you're working with a midwife or an NP or a physician or a PA that is, you know, more functionally or integrative medicine trained, they might be helpful in terms of having that conversation. But how many of us did not get fully informed consent when we agreed to start taking these medications? So ask your provider, is there a certain period of time that I should take this? And what are my other options? Or I want to be on this for just a certain duration of time to lessen the net impact on my bone health. I think that's an important conversation to have, because I think for so many of us, when we were making those decisions years ago, we were just like, oh, this is going to fix my hormones. Well, it just kind of puts a Band-Aid on it. But again, no judgment. Just make sure that you're having that conversation. And if your healthcare provider is not willing to have that conversation, then it just speaks to the fact that you probably need to find someone that is more open-minded. And that in and of itself is not an impossibility.
Wise words. Thanks for sharing. And one other question about for fasting, any other considerations for somebody that maybe has adrenal dysfunction or cortisol dysregulation?
That's a perfect question, because I literally this morning just took one of my clients. I just said, you have to stop fasting. So we have to understand that our adrenal glands are an emergency backup system. They are a stress management system. And until we go into perimenopause, or, you know, they're kind of like a backup quarterback, if you will. Well, all of a sudden our ovaries aren't producing as much progesterone and our adrenal glands kind of now have to step in. They're a first string. You know, they have to step in. You can tell I have kids that play sports. So now they're a first string. And it's understanding that if you aren't sleeping, if you're stressed to the max, you're going through a divorce, you lost your job, you had a bad breakup, et cetera, got a bad car accident, that's probably not the time to add more gasoline to the fire. If you are doing CrossFit 5 days a week and you are not giving yourself an opportunity to have recovery days, if you are eating a standard American diet, guess what? You are adding a lot more inflammation and stress to that body. And so I'm so glad that you brought this up, because I see a lot of women, and I do lab work, so I can look at their labs and see, is their cortisol high? Like, you know, fasting is stressing them out. Or is their cortisol totally low and they're really depleted, and adding more fasting is probably going to be adding, as I said, gasoline to the fire. It doesn't necessarily mean that fasting per se is a no for them forever. It may be that they need to get beyond, they need to heal before they can get beyond this point to be able to add more stress to their body. And I'll give you an example, myself included. When I went through, you know, prior to leaving clinical medicine, I had a whole 6 to 12 months where I was so tired, I could barely get out of bed. I was not depressed. I ran every kind of test you could imagine. My thyroid was in the toilet. My adrenals were in the toilet. I had a parasite infection. You better believe there was a period of time I was not fasting, or I was not doing more than 12 to 13 hours of fasting. And so I think it's always taken in the context of, like, let's check in with yourself. What's going on in your personal life? Because if you are in perimenopause or menopause, you are less stress resilient. That doesn't mean you're incapable, doesn't mean you're a lovely, capable person. But I know for myself, when I have days where my stress levels are high, I have to really do a lot of extra things to help balance those adrenals. And there's lots of very benign things you can do: connection to nature, grounding, electrolytes, PMF mat. Heck, you don't necessarily have to have gadgets. I love gadgets. I'm like a gadget nerd. But, you know, more minerals, so more vitamin C, more electrolytes, more magnesium. Maybe you get a massage. Maybe you take a nap. These are all really, really important. So if your adrenals are thrashed, or you've been told that your cortisol levels are dysregulated, either too high or too low, it can be a sign that maybe what you need to do is 12 hours of digestive rest. Maybe you need to not go so low carb. Like, a lot of people have demonized carbohydrates. And I have to remind people that carbohydrates are not inherently bad. It's what we've done to the carbohydrates that makes them inherently not so healthy. So, you know, I'm not going to, you know, tell my patients don't have some berries, but I am going to say don't have the ice cream. Like, let's make some better choices, better quality foods that maybe have a little bit of fiber, going to fill you up, going to, you know, keep your blood sugar stable, as opposed to the processed stuff, you know, the bread, the pasta, the rice, the things that can get a lot of women in particular in trouble. And the last thing I would add to that is, when we're talking about things that are tonifying or helpful for our adrenal glands, it's the things that I've talked about, but it's also adaptogenic herbs as having like a really good place, that are, they're plant-based compounds, things like ashwagandha, rhodiola, rhodiola, shishanda, holy basil, things that can actually tonify. So if you need some energy, they can help provide some energy. If you need to kind of quiet cortisol, they can be beneficial. Again, don't guess. Get tested and then know. But I do find that adaptogenic herbs, and I take them, I mean, every single day, because, you know, as a middle-aged woman, there's stuff, you know, an entrepreneur, it's like, you know, your days are like this, you know, they're all over the place, can really be helpful. But I think that's an important distinction. If your adrenals are not optimized, adding in more stress, whether even if it's beneficial in the form of hormesis, can be a problem.
And sometimes, I mean, we're talking about, sometimes you have to address another health issue. It's almost like unlocking the ability to address the other health issue, right? You have to address one before the next one can happen. And a perfect example of this could be chronic inflammation, right? I've talked about this so much. Chronic inflammation, especially if it's, taking place long-term, mm-hmm. that's going to negatively impact our health. It's going to negatively impact our bones. And I know that fasting can be a tool to help get that in check, right?
Yes. And I think I always think about it that yes. And so it isn't just the fasting, it's the foods you choose to eat in your feeding window. So if you're eating nutrient dense, whole foods, healthy protein, healthy fats, and by that means no seed oils, you're eating the right types of carbohydrates for your body, depending on how physically active you are, how insulin sensitive you are, where you are in your menstrual cycle. I absolutely agree that it can help reduce inflammation, but inflammation can be driven up by underlying infections. It can be driven up by toxins you're exposed to. It can be driven up by crappy sleep and I hate to keep picking on women, but women seem to be the ones that they get by on saying, I haven't slept well in 10 years. And I'm like, oh my gosh, how do you function? I don't sleep well in one day and I can barely like get myself together. But understanding that inflammation can be mitigated by many things. And acute inflammation is not a bad thing. It's chronic, unrelenting inflammation, which leads to oxidative stress and mitochondrial dysfunction and just kind of creates this perfect storm. And the unfortunate thing is, I think so many of us have just accepted that inflammation is part of our lives, whether it's an achy joint, whether it's, inflammation in our stomach, like we're chronically bloated or we're dealing with constipation or diarrhea, or even just the hormonal changes that occur throughout our menstrual cycles, or even in perimenopause and menopause. And we just assume it's so benign. And I always remind people like inflammation is this like kind of slow burning fire underneath everything that we don't per se see. We don't understand how destructive it can be if we're not properly managing it.
And maybe we could talk about fasting and bone health. Now, you and I have kind of talked about this a little bit, but I think there's more research, right, that has to be done in this area. I mean, from what I found, there's limited research showing, what the longest period of time could be that a fast could have a negative impact on someone's bones. What have you found in terms of the research and what it shows for fasting and bone health?
Well, and it's interesting because this is a question we've been asked so frequently. I actually did a little like YouTube video on it. And to your point, there's not enough substantive research. And I think it always comes back to what else are you doing along with fasting? So if you are lifting weights, you are getting plenty of sleep, you are eating a nutrient-dense diet, all of those metrics, if you are of a certain age and HRT is an option for you. And that's again, a very bio-individual decision. We know that those things can be very beneficial. So I think on a lot of different levels, like the more I understand about the changes that go on hormonally as we transition into late perimenopause and the menopause, the more a fan I am of using HRT, but also being smart about fasting. Like I tell everyone, you do not get a medal if you are over fasting and over exercising and over restricting. So an appropriate amount of time that you are in a fasted state, I'll be completely transparent. Depending on how hungry I am, some days I break my fast earlier. If I've been doing more lifting and I'm more hungry, I break it earlier. So the concept of white knuckling fasting is definitely not a strategy that I recommend. But getting back to the bone health piece, I have not seen anyone whose bone health is not improved, but I think it's also in the context of and again, I speak to women that are more proactive about their health in general are going to be more proactive about their bone health. Like, I think that those things are, they're the people that are going to want to talk about the supplements. They're going to talk about what physical activity they need to be doing. They're going to be conscientious about their nutrition and their sleep and their stress management. And so it could be that the women that I interact with are just part of a group of individuals who are more proactive about their health in general, as opposed to and I had plenty of these patients in cardiology that were just like, I found out I did a DEXA at like 65. I'm osteoporotic. I didn't know I was osteoporotic. I don't know how long I've been osteoporotic. And then the next step is they go on. And I know we talked about this on my podcast, some of the medications that maybe stimulate bone growth, but not necessarily healthy bone growth. and not realizing there are other options. So I think there's definitely two distinct kind of avatars that are out there. And again, I'm generalizing, but the people that I'm interacting with, women I'm interacting with, tend to be very proactive. They want to know, they want to, you know, work on as much preventative things as possible. So as we talk about, you educate, inspire, and empower people, and then they can help lead their decision-making and lead their healthcare practitioners to be able to help them create, you know, the kind of like long-term impact that they want to make. So I think for me, I acknowledge that I have a particular group of people that tend to gravitate towards me that are going to be more proactive about their health in general, probably very similar to mm-hmm. your client population as well.
Very much so. And I would say too, with any health strategy that you're implementing in your own life, it's not as if you just have to do it and guess what's going on or just guess what's going on internally. Look at the biomarkers. You can go get bone turnover markers and see if the things that you're doing are increasing or decreasing your bone resorption, your bone formation. And there are markers to look for that, the CTX, the NTX, your 24-hour urine calcium. You can look at bone formation markers. All of those things can help you get a better picture as it relates to your bone health of what's going on. So if you're implementing some of these strategies and you see that your CTX is, you know, 800 or 900, that's not just going to change from making some adjustments in your nutrition, right? There's probably some other things that have to take place there. So I'm so glad. Any other things that you think are important for us to highlight or touch on, Cynthia?
Well, I think it really comes down to understanding that intermittent fasting can be a great strategy. I do believe that it helps to contribute to bone health metrics that are of benefit. But if intermittent fasting isn't a strategy that works well for you, you can still benefit from doing 12 hours of digestive rest. In fact, maybe one day my teenagers will be able to go more than 12 hours without eating, but they eat like all constantly, but they're also still growing. So if you're listening to this and you're saying, you know, I tried it, it didn't work for me, there's definitely strategies to help you kind of slowly get your way there. I do talk about them in the book. I think from my perspective, just understanding the power of N of one, like what might work well for you may not work for your best friend. And that's okay. I think, unfortunately, I was part of a traditional allopathic model where we literally treated most patients all the same. And I now fervently believe that experimentation is important, trying things out, being open-minded. I know we both kind of embrace this concept, really is the best way to navigate choices for yourself, you know, moving forward.
Yeah. And I would wholeheartedly agree with that. And for those of you listening that are like, okay, well, I'm going to go try this, or I'm going to make sure that I'm at least not eating for a 12-hour period, which I think is a great starting point. Some people haven't even gone that long. Think of that, 7 p.m. at night to 7 in the morning. That is 12 hours. Can you do that? Can you not snack in the evenings or snack throughout the day and just have designated meals? That could be a great starting point. And if you're like, well, how am I going to get that amount of protein in during a certain time? Maybe consider adding a protein shake or something like that too. So that could be really helpful. Cynthia, this has been absolutely amazing. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. And maybe we could share, where can people find you? And what are some resources that you have available that people can have access to?
Absolutely. So if you go to my website, www.cynthiathurlow.com, you can get access to my podcast, Everyday Wellness, that Kevin was a recent guest on, a very popular podcast episode. You can find me on social media. I have a free Facebook group called Intermittent Fasting Lifestyle /my name. I have men and women in that group. I'm probably most active on Instagram. It's Cynthia_Thurlow_. And then you may find me on Twitter, and I'm a little bit snarky. So be forewarned, depends on the day. Sometimes people are like, whoa, I had no idea. I was like, I grew up in New Jersey. But yeah, I would love to connect with your listeners. I've got a couple really cool supplements that have come out, one of which, based on clinical research, may be of great benefit to individuals that are looking to improve bone health, which is creatine, a monohydrate.
That's great. Well, so for everybody listening, everything Cynthia just mentioned here, you could find all the resources, show notes, everything mentioned over at bonecoach.com/Cynthia Thurlow Fasting Bone Health. I want to thank you again so much for your time, everyone. We'll see you in the next episode. Hope you found this episode of the Bone Coach Show helpful. You can find all the resources, show notes, everything mentioned over at bonecoach.com. If you enjoyed this episode and found it helpful, be sure to share it with someone you love, a friend, family member, even a group of people. And also be sure to hit that subscribe button so you never miss an episode that can help you improve your bones, your health, and your future. One last reminder, if you haven't done so already, head over to bonecoach.com for more great resources to help you get on the path to stronger bones and an active future. I'm your Bone Coach, Kevin Ellis. I'll see you in the next episode.